From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The disability rights movement is a stealth movement. Most people know about the women, the African-American civil rights movement. They know about the women's movement. Many even know about the gay rights movement. But nobody knows about the disability rights movement, even though it is probably the largest minority movement of all.
Today is the 10th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll take a look at the movement from charity to confrontation. And President Clinton ends the Middle East peace talks. Some say this means the beginning of serious negotiations. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat are returning to the Middle East amid heightened security after their failure to clinch a peace deal. Israeli and Palestinian security forces are bracing for possible violence today after the breakdown of the Marathon Camp David talks. Hundreds of Palestinians marched in Gaza demanding a resumption of their uprising, or intifada, against Israel. The Islamic militant group Hamas urged Arafat to return to the armed struggle. A products pipeline caught fire in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, today. Near Nigeria's main oil hub of Port Harcourt, military troops have been called in. A resident of the area told Reuters two villagers had been badly burned but not killed, and so far were the only known casualties of the blast at Eleme. Outside the refinery town, crude oil export facilities did not appear to be threatened. Hundreds of people were killed earlier this month in a spate of pipeline explosions in the oil-producing area around the refinery town of Warri. At least 18 villagers were burned to death Monday in the latest blaze in the Warri area. This news from Missouri. The NAACP in Springfield, Missouri, is calling on the city council to consider making reparations to the black community for the 1906 lynchings of three black men on a downtown square. A group of citizens has tried to get the city council to recognize the lynchings with a plaque downtown. City leaders have refused. Earlier this year, an Oklahoma State Commission recommended reparations for black survivors of a 1921 rampage by white mobs in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Historians say as many as 300 African Americans were killed in 1994. $2 million in compensation was approved for nine survivors and dozens of descendants of the 1923 attack on blacks in Rosewood, Florida. Air France said today the Concorde plane that crashed and killed 113 people during takeoff yesterday had been delayed for last-minute maintenance on one of its engines. Air France said the crash appeared to have been caused by a fire in one of the engines at the moment of takeoff. Experts said possible causes of the fire range from birds flying into the air intake to mechanical failure. The French Ministry of Transportation said the two flight data recorders were damaged but had been found. Air France already grounded all Concorde flights today. British Airways canceled its two Tuesday night flights but resumed Concorde service today between New York and London after completing safety checks. Hundreds of thousands of people marched through Havana early today demanding an end to the U.S. blockade against Cuba. The march coincides with the 47th anniversary of the attack on an army barracks by Fidel Castro and his comrades that launched the Cuban Revolution. The rebels seized power 6 years later on New Year's Day in 1959. They overthrew the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista. A report by the California Public Interest Research Group says children, parents, and teachers are rarely notified when toxic pesticides are used at hundreds of California public schools. While some school districts have policies requiring notification, there's no statewide policy requiring schools to inform people of pesticide use. A week before Philadelphia stages the Republican National Convention, union leaders and Philadelphia Mayor John Street reached a labor agreement that prevented what could have been an embarrassing strike by sanitation workers. The workers secured pay raises and increased health care allowances. And the Clinton administration says health maintenance organizations will drop nearly 1 million older Americans from their coverage plans next year. Citing overregulation and insufficient coverage, many HMOs have abandoned Medicare, leaving an increasing number of elderly and disabled Americans off the once heralded program. Congress and President Clinton have pledged to consider additional HMO funding. And the Chilean Supreme Court yesterday denied a request for special medical tests for General Augusto Pinochet before the High Court rules on whether the former dictator can be stripped of his immunity from prosecution.
Justice is done.
Foreign policy.
I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Crime and punishment.
Today, the Board of Pardons and Paroles voted to allow Mr. Graham's execution. Justice is done.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Join me and Juan Gonzalez for 2 weeks of expanded convention coverage. From July 31st to August 4th, we'll be live from Philadelphia. And August 14th to August 18th, live from Los Angeles. We'll be covering the convention, the shadow conventions. We'll be in the corporate suites and live from the protests in the streets. It's a multimedia extravaganza. We'll be broadcasting on community radio, on public access television, on Dish Network, and the Internet. Tune in.
Soon the world will be ours.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As you heard at the top of the program, the big news of the day and the headlines, Clinton ends deadlocked peace talks. We'll take a look at how the New York Times put it with a sub-headline, Barack is praised, Arafat is said to show less flexibility over fate of Jerusalem. At the end of 2 weeks of marathon negotiations with the leaders of Israel and the Palestinians, a visibly fatigued President Clinton announced yesterday they were unable to reach an agreement, quote, at this time. The president and other American mediators made clear it was Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, who balked in the end, and by all accounts, the issue was Jerusalem, the holy city both Israelis and Palestinians claim as their sacred capital. Speaking at the White House, Clinton singled out the Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, for his readiness to make hard compromises, saying, I would be making a mistake not to praise Barak because I think he took a big risk. The president went on to say the prime minister moved forward more from his initial position than Chairman Arafat, particularly surrounding the question of Jerusalem. He also declared that the discussions at Camp David had been really unprecedented in raising issues, quote, that had long been considered off limits. The issue of Jerusalem in particular had never been discussed before by Palestinians and Israelis in face-to-face encounters. We turn now to George Irani, a professor of political science at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning, Amy.
Well, what do you think of the spin of the New York Times on the end of the peace talks between Arafat and Barak?
Not surprising. It belongs to the usual line to blame the victim. And basically, the victims in this case are always the Palestinians. And they are always supposed to make concessions upon concessions. And of course, Arafat is going to be chided for, you know, foiling the Camp David show, but there are many political layers behind that we can talk about, Amy.
Talk about the issue of Jerusalem.
Well, Jerusalem is a complicated issue because it's a city that is unique in terms that it's a symbol for more than, 2.5 billion people, for, 40 million Jews around the world, 1 billion Christians and 1 billion Muslims, so it gives you a large crowd of people interested in the fate of the city. That's one. Two, it's a city also that had a long, troubled history of occupations and presences all the way back to the Crusades, to the Ottomans, to the British, to Jordanian Israeli, and to now total Israeli, if you want, occupation of East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem being the under Israeli control since 1948. Jerusalem also has a different transnational dimension because it's not only Israelis and Palestinians that have a stake in it. There are many other institutions that have, presence that have interest there, such as the Vatican, such as the Orthodox churches, be it the Russian presence in the Muscovia in Jerusalem, be it the Orthodox Greek Orthodox presence in Jerusalem, be it the Armenians, the Copts, the Maronites, you know, a big mosaic of people that have a stake in that. So Arafat alone could not, neither Barak could not negotiate that without bringing all these folks into the picture. So that's the other thing. The third very fundamental thing is that Israel today has, you know, today, since 1967, has occupied and annexed East Jerusalem and made it its capital. And only, I think, three countries in the world recognize that. I think Costa Rica, El Salvador, and Zaire, I think, have their capitals in Jerusalem. Most of the other countries, including the United States, their embassies are in Tel Aviv. And what is also very interesting, that inside East Jerusalem, there are several countries that have consulates, including the United States. The United States has a consulate in East Jerusalem, which is independent from the embassy in Tel Aviv, U.S. embassy. The same, the French, the Italians, the Spanish, and the Belgians. And this goes back to the old status quo under the Ottomans, who have, you know, acknowledged that, you know, East Jerusalem, Jerusalem itself must have its own special status, and protected from any exclusive control.
What about the critical issues, for example, of water, of the right of return of Palestinians?
This is the key issue. Basically, you know, if you remember, Christopher Hitchens once said, you know, you should always pay attention to the dogs that don't bark. And the dogs that didn't bark in this whole deal, unfortunately, is the question of the refugees. And the Israeli governments from 1948 onwards, they don't want to hear about the question of compensation, the whole question about policing the past, which is today very relevant in Chile, in Argentina, and other parts of the world. For instance, the refugees in Kosovo went back, while the Israeli government does not want the Palestinian refugees, especially from 1948, to be compensated or go back to their former lands. And this is the issue, I think. I think this is where the whole deal lies, because the current Israeli leadership is keen on having the Palestinians sign a peace treaty and also declare officially and publicly that the Palestinians have no more claims of compensation against the Israeli government or the Israeli people. And I think this is a very hard pill to swallow for the Palestinians.
And what do you think is going to happen now with Barak and Arafat flying home? What about what it is to be on the ground right now in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, Amy, you see, since the beginning of this whole charade, I call it the pacification process in the Middle East, not the peace process. Pacification, like our famous natives here, Native Americans. Basically, the charade is that it has been a peace concocted by leaders, be it Sadat, be it Begin, be it Netanyahu, be it Arafat, and so on, or Barak. The grassroots themselves are not ready. Neither, even, you know, the claim made today that Barak had prepared his public opinion for the concessions he was supposed to make. I think today 50% of the Israeli public opinion is against that. And, you know, we have seen this with various demonstrations in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, by the various settlers and their Likudnik friends and so on. And the same thing for the Palestinians and the various Arab public opinion at large. You know, they are the victims, and they feel that, you know, things are being negotiated that are crucial, very symbolic, against, you know, their opinion, against, you know, the overall perception that this whole peace deal has been a very unjust, very unfair, and whereby the United States did not play the role, quote-unquote, of honest broker, but it played the role of the, if you want, the, what I call it, the water carrier for the Israeli public opinion or public elite policies, basically. So that's the, so what's going to happen now is that you have a weak leader coming back to Israel, Barak. Yeah, he did not make concessions, but he has no government. If he forms a national unity government with Likud, forget about peace. That means we're going to have a freeze until the new administration comes here in Washington. And then, as far as Arafat is concerned, he too is, you know, health-wise, is not in good shape. And also his internal house, he needs to, you know, put it in order. Of course, he comes in a little bit stronger because he did not give concessions. Today, the overall opinion in the Arab world, the various media and comments, is that, you know, it was a victory, that the failure of Camp David was a victory for Arafat, a victory for the Arabs, the Palestinians, who did not have to make the hard, you know, the concessions that they were forced to do, basically, at Camp David. So we can foresee, Amy, a period of trouble, a turmoil. I also would put Lebanon into this whole deal, where you have more than 350,000 Palestinian refugees rotting in their camps in a horrible condition. They could be also very easy tool to manipulate to revamp the South Lebanon option. Not at this stage. I think from until the end of this year, South Lebanon is going to be quiet. But it's something to keep in mind. And then you still have the Golan Heights, too, which could be another, you know, source. It could be trouble, it could be peace. But from now until, let's say, next spring, a year from now, I don't see anything moving on the whole Middle East issue in terms of the peace process, so-called peace process.
Well, Professor George Irani, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Irani teaches political science at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on with the rest of the program, which we will be devoting to this 10th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. 10 years ago, the ADA was signed. Many say the disability rights movement is different from the civil rights movement and the women's movement in that it is almost invisible in this country, except to those, of course, who are actively participating in it. The history of disability rights mirrors the history of the country. Both world wars sparked changes in disability policy as many young people came home with disabilities, and changes in medical technology as veterans without limbs and with other disabilities returned to the country. The empowerment of people with disabilities has become another chapter in the struggles over identity politics that began in the 1960s. It's a complex story that we look at of shifts in consciousness and shifts in policy, of changing focuses on particular disabilities such as blindness, deafness, polio, quadriplegia, psychiatric and developmental disabilities, chronic conditions like cancer and heart disease and AIDS, and of activism and policymaking across disabilities. And today we're going to go across the country to talk with people who've been a part of the movement for many years. We're going to begin with Frieda Zames. She is co-author of a book that is just coming out now called The Disability Rights Movement, From Charity to Confrontation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Frieda Zames.
Thank you. Hi.
Well, what does today mean to you?
Well, this is the most important, or one of the most important laws, federal laws, in the whole history of disability rights. It's not as strong as we would like. The enforcement is fairly weak. But it gives us the power to sue and to demand our rights in many areas, in state and city government, in private in the private sector, and you know it. And it took many years to get this. Actually, there were two laws necessary. We're the only movement where there were really two laws. One law that had to do with the federal agencies or institutions that received federal funds. That was way in the 70s. And then we needed another law to include the private entities. And so that's the Americans with Disabilities Act, which put it all together.
Arlene Meyerson is also with us, who's the directing attorney of Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Arlene Meyerson, can you explain the legal battle and what these what the Americans for Disabilities Act came out of?
Well, it came out of a 20-year history of disability civil rights and an independent living movement that learned its lessons from the more traditional civil rights movements of blacks and women to realize that without a law to enforce, there would never be equal opportunity.
The first act was passed when?
The first national act was passed in 1973, the Rehabilitation Act, and there was a provision in there banning discrimination by anyone who received federal financial assistance. And that law really laid the foundation for the later enactments. That law, in the 1973 law, there were comprehensive regulations put out in 77. And those regulations set forth what kinds of obligations employers would have and other public entities would have.
And 1990?
Well, from 77 to 90, the 80s were filled with, number one, fighting back cutbacks in the laws from the United States Supreme Court. And in every cloud, there's a silver lining. The silver lining was that the disability community really coalesced and learned to be a very effective lobbyist and
Arlene Mayerson,
opponent of, on the Hill. And so from the really at the 80s, there was a incremental move to increase civil rights and to fight back any cutbacks from the Supreme Court, and that all led to the development of an ABA.
Arlene Mayerson, Directing Attorney in Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, along with Frieda Zames, the co-author of the Disability Rights Movement. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves and fan out around the country to talk with people about what the Americans with Disabilities Act has meant to them. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now. I'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look today at the Americans with Disabilities Act, today is the 10th anniversary of the passage of that law, and we're joined by a roundtable of people. By the way, I also want to welcome WEFT to the Democracy Now! Family, broadcasting out of Champaign, Illinois. They've just begun airing Democracy Now! And we're going to go down to another station that airs us, and that is KXCI FM in Tucson, Arizona, where Mike Landwehr is standing by. He is the program director of KXCI and has long been involved with the disability rights movement. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mike Landwehr.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to have you with us. The whole issue of the disability rights movement and how it got its start, particularly after World War II, can you talk about that time?
Yes, people were returning with injuries that beforehand they would not have survived, and so there were a lot of new disabilities out with young people who were anxious to get back to their lives, get back to going to school, getting their education, getting into the workforce, and finding a lot of barriers as they moved into that. Out of this, I think some of the universities were setting up programs to allow people with disabilities to come in. They were very, very restrictive in who they would let in. At the University of Illinois, where I went, for example, you couldn't get in at a certain time unless you were able to push your own wheelchair. If you needed a power chair or needed assistance, they pretty much wanted people that they could get onto their wheelchair basketball teams and so forth and present that kind of an image. So there were a lot of restrictions. There was a lot of paternalism in the system. You had to, everything that had to be approved by the university had to be approved by the rehab center and so forth. You were kind of in a different world and pretty segregated as well. And it was that segregation, I think, that drove people to look for ways of getting into the whole system and not just pieces of it. And that's when people started banding together, particularly at the University of California in Berkeley, where there was a program for severely disabled people who were living together in kind of a rehab unit. And it was these people in particular who got together and formed the first Center for Independent Living in Berkeley, California. Now there are those kinds of centers all over the country. And it gives people a an opportunity, a place to communicate with each other and to form coalitions of people with all kinds of disabilities to lobby for the services and the rights that they need.
Mike Landwehr, you use a wheelchair yourself. At what age did you begin to use it?
I was born with spina bifida, which is a congenital disability, an opening in the spine, and I've been using a wheelchair since I was 12 years old. That was in 1956. So I've seen a lot of these changes when I was, well, when I was first disabled, which happened in the hospital. To show you how far we've come in just the last 40, 45 years, when it was time for me to be released from the hospital, I walked into the hospital. I was unable to walk when I came out. The nurse picked me up out of the bed and handed me to my mother to carry off. There was no rehabilitation. There was no suggestion as to what was going to happen next with me. We, the family, had to kind of figure all of this out, including figuring out that I was going to need a wheelchair to get around in. So from that point, then getting into the wheelchair and finding that I couldn't get into my neighborhood school, couldn't get even off my block because of the big curbs that they had in Chicago, there were barriers everywhere for me. Getting through high school, we did get to a high school that was relatively accessible in that there were no steps to get in, but they wouldn't let me go there in Chicago. They said they had a special school for handicapped children, and that's where they wanted to send me. These are very segregated situations where they train you primarily to be able to live in nursing homes when you grow up, and that's where most of those people ended up living, was in nursing homes. My family moved 60 miles outside of the city of Chicago just to get me into a school that would allow me to enter. There were barriers. There were steps all over the place. The bathrooms were not accessible. They said I could go there, but I was not to expect that they were going to make any accommodations for me whatsoever. I had to depend on my schoolmates to carry me up and downstairs to classes, to get me into the building, to help me into the bathroom, all of that. And I managed to get through 4 years of high school that way. It was quite a struggle, but it was one of those picking yourself up by the bootstraps situations that it was good for me in that I was in an integrated setting that whole time, and I wasn't just with disabled people. That has changed a great deal with the laws that now have broken down all of those barriers.
And what did the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act mean for you?
Well, it opened up even more doors. We heard Arlene Mayerson talking about the about Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act in 1973. Those regulations came out in 1978, and they affected federally funded programs, so schools and governments had to begin making things accessible and available and usable by people with disabilities. But it wasn't until the ADA came around that it really opened a lot of new doors. Private enterprise had to participate in this. Hotels, public accommodations in town, movie theaters, concert venues, as well as schools and places of employment. This has made it possible for all of us to, it's opened up doors for us to be able to work, continue higher education and so forth. It's really made a huge difference. And I think as people see the ramped curbs and the elevators, the lifts, and the signing for deaf people at concerts, and other kinds of assistance, I think it's becoming more visible in the community as a result of the ADA. And as people become more and more aware of the difficulties and the barriers that we face and the breaking down of those barriers, I think society has become more open to people with disabilities than they ever have been before. We have a long way to go here, but those first steps have been taken.
Mike Landwehr is the program director of K KXCI in Tucson, Arizona, and a well-known disability rights activist. Paul Miller also is on the line with us, a Clinton appointee to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and he's charged with implementing the Americans with Disabilities Act. If you just heard before Arlene Mayerson, we've got people on cell phones because there's a major event taking place at the White House today. Everyone is heading over. In fact, most people are there now, where President Clinton and former President Bush are expected to be. Well, President Clinton today and Bush will be joining him tonight at a major gala for the ADA. Paul Miller, what can employers, what discrimination is legal and what isn't?
Well, thank you for having me on your show. It's been a very interesting discussion thus far. Discrimination is illegal, so no discrimination is allowed. The question is, what is discrimination? And I think it's important to note that just as Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of race and gender, the ADA prohibits discrimination in exactly the same way. That is, the underlying principle of the employment section of the ADA says that employers must treat people on the job based upon their ability to do the work rather than based upon a fear, myth, or stereotype due to their disability. That's really the very simple cornerstone of the ADA and a simple principle that the ADA mandates.
What are the biggest cases of discrimination that you've had to deal with at the EEOC?
Well, the EEOC receives charges of discrimination from people with disabilities all over the country, and we see lots of stories of discrimination, people who are simply fired once they become disabled, employers who refuse to make even the simplest reasonable accommodation, that is to modify the workplace to enable a disabled person to work, people refusing to get promotions. Those are the kinds of discrimination that we see coming to the EEOC.
I'm curious. My grandmother lives in a place. She's 103 years old and still extremely vibrant, but sometimes it's difficult for her to walk. And it's a, I guess, living assisted place with a lot of older people who eat together downstairs and they live in their own apartments upstairs. But they're not allowed to use wheelchairs in the lobby. And people are not allowed in who would come to this place in wheelchairs. Is that illegal?
That's not illegal under the employment section. So I'll pass that over to Arlene Mayerson.
Arlene Mayerson of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund.
Correct. Yes, I think that it is illegal.
Even if it's a private place.
Yeah, they have no right.
The ADA, the big difference in the ADA and its predecessor laws is that the ADA extends the non-discrimination provisions to the private sector. That is the big difference with the ADA. That's why it was such a landmark, because it the previous law had only covered those entities that received federal financial assistance. The ADA is comprehensive.
And if places say, for example, older people going into sort of group living situations, not really group living, but in independent apartments, that you can't come into a place, you know, originally move into a place if you are in a wheelchair. They won't start with people who are already in wheelchairs. Is this illegal?
Yes. I think that's illegal. We have heard many cases about retirement homes, particularly retirement homes, actually, that have those policies that if you use a wheelchair, you can't bring it to the dining room.
Right.
Or if you do bring it to the dining room, you have to be the last one in.
Right.
I actually think that those kinds of cases are ripe for litigation.
Mm-hmm. You, Frieda Zames, you are vigorously shaking your head when you hear this. Frieda Zames, co-author of the Disability Rights Movement with her sister-in-law, from charity to conference.
Sister.
Oh, excuse me.
We go way back.
Sister, you go way back.
We go way back from the beginning.
That's Doris Zames Fleischer, who wrote the book with Frieda Zames.
She's a writer, actually.
Right. I want to talk about the two of you. Who's older?
I am.
You're older. How long have you been in a wheelchair?
Well, I did walk with crutches and braces, but I got polio when I was 2 1/2. So I've been disabled, as far as I'm concerned, all my life. I don't remember anything else.
Well, seeing you in this wheelchair actually really warms my heart, because my dad used a similar one. Is this an Amiga?
This is an Amiga, and it was this model was the first model of the Amiga. I still love it.
Mm-hmm. May I interject, because I think this will give you a sense of who Frida is. Frida had polio when she was 2 1/2. By the way, my personal statement, I say it's the most important thing that happened in my life. It only happened 2 years before I was born. But let me just tell you about Frida. Frida used to walk with crutches and braces. And then, because she's post-polio, which means that, well, it doesn't mean you get sicker. I won't go into the medical reason. You get weaker, but, you know, you look at Frida, she's still plenty strong. Okay, in any case, so she has to go into an Amiga. Her reaction to it was, I used to walk with crutches and braces. I had to be afraid people were going to knock me down. Now I'm in an Amigo. They have to be afraid I'm going to knock them down. She said, that expresses me much better.
So actually, this issue of technology is very integral to the disability rights movement. I mean, I think of the women's movement, how the dishwasher freed women up, for example. That's what about technology?
Well, we have a whole, you know, we deal with technology, and to a great extent, it really did make a big difference. I mean, it kind of works together with the movement, the technology. As the technology improves, the movement can do more, and vice versa. But there are also negative effects, so we talk about the positive and the negative effects.
What are the negative effects?
Well, for example, something simple like a curb cut, it's good for the person in the wheelchair, but it's a problem for blind people. But more other situations,
because
they don't know they're going into the street unless they know ahead of time. But that's a very simple, and that can be dealt with.
Technology.
That can be dealt with, yeah, because we just train each other, you know, we work together. But there are more serious things, like with computers, the whole privacy issue. I mean, for example, you can get to know more about what possible disabilities you may have in later life, but so may your employer find out and not hire you, or somebody you're looking for a job.
Or you won't get insurance, which means that even for a disability which you may never have. For example, given the human genome, mapping the human genome, you could be susceptible. I mean, somebody who would be more likely to get that than somebody else, but you may never get it. You know what I mean? So that you may be not be able to get insurance, and then you can't get a job.
Technology can also be very expensive.
People with disabilities are the single segment of society that can gain most from the electronic age, and yet only 1/4 of people with disabilities own computers. 1/10 ever make use of the internet, and the main reason is that, and of course, it would be, look, a person in a who's a using a computer. It doesn't matter if you got there in a wheelchair. Somebody who's not technologically adept, if you can walk to the computer, is less able than the person in the wheelchair. But the main reason for it is that people with disabilities can't afford the computer, can't afford the specialized software that they require. And so we're, of course, limiting the people with disabilities, but we're also making them impossible for them self-sustaining.
But what about other kinds of technology, not just computers, but what helps you, for example, get around?
Yeah, I mean, for example, the scooters, the motorized wheelchair, enabled a lot more people to get around. The lifts on buses enabled us to use public transportation. Trains, elevators, and trains. I mean, these technologies really made a big difference. Although elevators were known things, they weren't way out new things. But people just didn't conceive of people in wheelchairs moving around, going for jobs, going, you know, living like everyone else. And we were trapped.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also talk about disabilities that may not be visible to the human eye, but that people have to deal with every day.
That's most disabled people.
That's overwhelmingly.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guests are Dara Zames Fleischer and Frieda Zames. They're authors of the book, The Disability Rights Movement from Charity to Confrontation. On the line with us, Paul Miller, Clinton appointee to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, charged with implementing the Americans with Disabilities Act. Its 10th anniversary is today. Also, Arlene Mayerson, directing attorney of Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Mike Landwehr with us from Tucson, Arizona, program director of KXCI-FM, a community radio station there. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the 10th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, a roundtable conversation around the country about what this means. We're also joined on the telephone by Andy Imperato, who is the executive director of American Association of People with Disabilities. What about disabilities that are not visible to the eye, just automatically, someone understands that you might have a walking impairment, or that you can't see, or perhaps that you can't hear? Andy Imperato.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things that we're experiencing in the disability rights movement is a backlash against the ADA, and one of the themes in the backlash is that the wrong people are benefiting from the law, and they often talk about the fact that the second most common charge filed with the EEOC by disability type is people with mental impairments, particularly psychiatric disabilities. And there's this feeling that, you know, those disabilities somehow aren't as legitimate as somebody who's in a wheelchair or somebody who's blind or somebody who's deaf. I have a psychiatric disability. I actually used to work for Commissioner Miller at the EEOC. And the bottom line is that the fears, myths, and stereotypes that produce discrimination are sometimes even more powerful for people with hidden disabilities like psychiatric disabilities, and can produce even more egregious discrimination than for folks who are in wheelchairs or have a more visible disability.
Can you explain first what you're talking about when you say psychiatric disabilities?
Well, in my case, I have bipolar disorder or manic depression. The common forms of psychiatric disabilities are things like depression, mood disorders, schizophrenia. It's mental impairments that have been diagnosed and have an impact on functioning that limits major life activities.
And how are you protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Well, actually, one could make an argument that thanks to the Supreme Court and something they did last term, I may not be protected. The law, as it was written, talked about people with mental impairments being protected against discrimination in employment, insurance, other arenas. But the Supreme Court issued a series of decisions last term that said when you're determining whether or not somebody is impaired and is limited in a major life activity, you should look at how they're functioning with their medication. So somebody who's able to take medications and improve their functioning to the point where they're not experiencing the limitation or the significant limitation may not have any civil rights protections, even though they do experience discrimination.
What did the Supreme Court rule?
They said that when you look at whether or not somebody's covered, you take into account what they call a mitigating measure. In my case, it's medication. In somebody else's case, it might be a hearing aid. If somebody's able to bring their functioning up to a level where they're no longer substantially limited, then they lose their civil rights protections.
Commissioner Paul Miller, what did this mean for cases brought to the EEOC?
We were very disappointed in the Supreme Court's decision in this trilogy of cases. And, of course, the EEOC will continue to vigorously enforce the law as laid out by the Supreme Court. I do think that it's important, though, and that the EEOC focus on and that people focus on the underlying discrimination that occurs against people either who use mitigating measures or who have hidden disabilities. In my mind, it's totally unfair that somebody who uses medication and, in fact, doing things to basically make themselves more productive and more useful in the workplace, that fact will be held against them by the Supreme Court under their doctrine of mitigating measures. I think what's really important is that we focus on the fact that some employers are focusing on myths, fears, and stereotypes, excluding qualified people from work in the workplace rather than letting them in. What's important to note is, after all, the ADA really seeks to empower disabled people who want to enter the workforce and become taxpayers rather than sitting at home collecting benefits and being tax users. And I have to ask myself, as a part of this society, where do I fall on the line? I line up behind people who want to work for a living.
Commissioner Paul Miller was appointed by Clinton to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, charged with implementing the ADA. Let's look at the original law and how it actually came into being, Frieda Zames.
Well, when you say the original law, what do you mean? The ADA?
Yeah.
Or the one before it. I mean, this took activism that actually was based in California.
Well, yes.
Well, I think she's referring to the fact that the same year that James Meredith broke the color line in Mississippi, what we think of as the father
Ed
of the
Roberts.
Movement, Ed Roberts, the father of the movement, a severely disabled man who had to sleep in an iron lung, broke the disability line in the University of California.
What was an iron lung?
An iron lung was it was a breathing device that people with polio, many people with polio, the upper respiratory system was affected and they could not breathe.
And he practically.
And it actually breathed for them. So in order for him to sleep at night, he had to go back into the iron lung. He would, and during the day, he would go to classes or go to demonstrations. This was the 60s in California. A lot of stuff was happening.
Well, he worked. He had a very important job. He was the head of the Office of Vocational.
Yeah, but that's after he graduated and got a degree.
And got a
master's. And I think. But the point is that he was a functioning person during the day as an activist and as a student. But at night he had to sleep in an iron lung. But he had to sue in order to get in the school. In fact, when he entered the school and applied, what he was told is, we tried cripples, they don't work. Those kinds of statements were allowed. I can say that when Frieda went for a job, her first jobs, people were able to say to her.
And they did.
They said, we can't hire you.
You're disabled.
You're disabled. This was allowed.
And Frieda Zames, what was your response?
That I can do the job. Give me a chance.
And the reason she got a job was because they needed people so badly, that they eventually, they took her in an insurance company and eventually in a university. And boy, did she pay them back. I mean, that is to say, she made herself very, very valuable to whatever institution she worked for.
And that's what happened, during the war. They would hire disabled people, and then after the war,
they would say they were unemployable. They would hire them during the war. Right. And then when the war was over and the GIs came back, they said people with disabilities, those same people were unemployable.
It's very similar to women.
Mm-hmm. Mike Landwehr in Tucson, Arizona, let's talk about images of people with disabilities in the media. You work in a community radio station, a different place than the rest of the media, but what can you say about you, the way you feel people are represented?
I think we're represented pretty poorly as a rule. If you
as loud as you can.
Yeah,
you're getting very quiet here.
Historically, we have, if you look at the disabled role models that we have in films and on television, we've had Mr. Magoo and a lot of jokes about not being able to see well and not admitting that's a problem. We've had it's very similar to when we saw blacks in early films and very stereotypical. And then we have Jerry Lewis parading kids around with disabilities, exploiting young people, raising money for a good cause, but at the same time demeaning the people that he's intending to assist. So we've had a lot of problems with that. People think because of the Jerry Lewis telethons that all kids who have disabilities are not going to grow up. They're going to die at a very young age, and people are afraid to hire somebody who is not going to be around to do the job. A lot of bad images have come out of people who have gotten up and started talking about us. That's turning around a little bit, and there is a little bit of a backlash where we're seeing a lot of politically incorrect humor across the board, but we're seeing people with disabilities once again being made fun of, and we don't have anybody on television or people in the movies that really fairly represent the life of a person with a disability. A couple of movies have tackled that subject pretty well. One was Coming Home. The other one was Born on the 4th of July. And outside of that, we don't have very much. We have pretty poor images, and it reflects very badly on all of the rest of us.
Yeah, I think the thing that bothers me the most about the media is that we're really given a chance to talk about our own issues, the political issues. I mean, you see people, you know, African Americans on television and radio talking about their issues. You see women talking about their issues, gay people, but we never get a chance to discuss our issues from our point of view. It's always other people talking about us. And I think that bothers me more than even the terrible images.
There's a good book out on the disability rights movement called Nothing About Us Without Us, which very well says it. Andy Imperato, for people who have psychiatric disabilities, what about the media representation of you? Andy, are you there? I guess no,
well, I can just give an example. Recent example from the New York Times.
Doris Ames Fleischer.
There was a group of articles in the New York Times about rampage killers, and it described people who go on shooting sprees. What it was? It was anecdotes about terrible people with psychiatric disability who go on shooting sprees. Somewhere hidden in a jump page of the third article was the statement that these people with psychiatric disabilities who use guns and shooting sprees form a very, very minute minority of these cases. It's very rare. But you wouldn't know that because it was a headline, you know, rampage killers. Now, the purpose that Fox Butterworth had, I think that's who it wrote the articles, was really...
Butterfield,
sorry, I didn't know the name was wrong. Fox Butterfield had for writing these articles was really about gun control. He was talking about these with people get guns. But in the process, he fed that stereotype. Peter Kramer, who's a famous psychologist, wrote, among other books, Listening to Prozac and many other books, has pointed out that people with psychiatric disabilities make excellent employees. People who are obsessive compulsive, they make really, you know, that's a worker that you want. And they have served us very well. They're in the gene pool for a reason. Abraham Lincoln was probably clinically depressed. By the way, psychiatric disabilities now forms the first, in terms of the number of cases that are bringing to the EEOC, it's now the number one cause of
I just want to make a point about people, employment. The hardest thing for a person with a disability is when you first go for a job, because You can't prove that you were discriminated against. All they have to say is we found someone more qualified.
The same thing that people with any other, you know, people with people of color, women, you can always say somebody else was more qualified. You don't see the other person's resume, so how do you sue?
In your book that the two of you wrote, as sisters looking at the disability rights movement, Frieda Zames and Doris Zames Fleischer, From Charity to Confrontation, you interviewed more than 100 people, activists and others dealing with physical and mental handicaps. What difference has that made for you, Frieda Zames? What did you learn?
Well, I think what I got from it was that the disability issue is throughout the country, and that there is a movement. This is a big country, and every area, every locality kind of does it its own way, deals with disability to some degree its own way. I mean, of course, we get together on federal laws, but it's the diversity in every community, in all races, you know, all different disabilities, and we've met such wonderful people, such amazing people, you know, that and how they deal with the discrimination, how they work to fight discrimination, and how we're being successful, because we have, as a group, we have very little money, we have very little, you know,
lobbying power.
I mean, they call us a disability lobby, but it's all a myth. There's no such lobby. I mean, it's just that when we're needed, we work together, and so we're considered a lobby. And it really was a wonderful experience interviewing all these different people.
I'd like to add that I think of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we indicate that as every American's insurance policy. After all, disability, it's the one ism everyone will probably at some point in their lives join. But we deal with it in our lives all the time, usually first in our family, parents, etc., and then in ourselves. But eventually, everybody becomes a member of the movement in a very personal and private way.
And unfortunately, very few people recognize this, very few non-disabled people.
And it's probably threatening, this. Too threatening to think about. So people don't want to
they
understand their relationship, their very personal relationship. They're not doing somebody else a favor. They're doing themselves a favor.
Mike Landwehr, your final comments on this day of the 10th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, of where we go from here, where the most effort must be put in now.
Well, we've definitely come a long way, and we're seeing the ADA under attack a little bit from the Supreme Court. We're going to have to teach the Supreme Court something about these laws. The laws that that got challenged last year in the last term, the Supreme Court was really wrong-headed about making these decisions about who is disabled and who's not. There are 2 points in the ADA that we haven't mentioned yet. There are 3 ways that you can be covered. One is if you obviously have a disability. One is if you're regarded as having a disability. And 3, if you have a history of having a disability. And they ignored those other 2 points when they made these decisions. And when they take a look at the ADA in the next term, when they're looking at constitutionality and so forth, they're going to have to look and understand this law a lot better than they already do. Those cases were pretty close. There were 5-4, so we only have to educate 1 Supreme Court member, and we'll be fine there.
That's about it, Mike. We have to wrap up the program. I want to thank you very much for being with us from Tucson, KXCI, program director there. And I also want to thank Andy Imparato from the American Association of People with Disabilities and the Zames sisters, their new book called The Disability Rights Movement, From Charity to Confrontation. Also, Commissioner Paul Miller of the EEOC. That does it for today's program. Earlier on the show, Arlene Mayerson of the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund, their website is deredf.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill. Thanks to Nell Geiser, Anthony Salone, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacific Radio's Democracy Now!